Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. When I say us, of course, it's moi, the Porkmeister, and rock chick extraordinaire from Fleet Street, Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, welcome. Isn't it wonderful to have the opportunity to speak to me again?
Oh, it's changed my life, Mike. It's fabulous to hear you again. I've been missing your dulcet tones and, thank God for technology. Here we are again.
Yeah, we certainly are. We've just got through Easter and we've just heard that there may be another 3 weeks of lockdown, so we're all prepared for that. Easter, to me, meant, Leslie Ann, I could have the one Easter egg I have a year. Well, obviously I don't have one Easter egg a year, but it's one of only two opportunities to eat chocolate a year. The other one is Christmas Day when I have a box of Roses chocolates. What about yourself? How did you indulge?
Well, my daughter has taken to baking cakes, chocolate cakes, smothered in this ganache that she makes out of Cadbury's dairy milk, massive great bars of it, and double cream, sort of melted in a bandouche over the stove. And I might as well have been slathering this stuff on my thighs as eating it, because it's heavy straight there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I certainly do. And, of course, we look back now on an Easter that was full of sunshine. People could have gone out. They didn't. Lockdown seems to be working a little bit more. Are we getting a bit more hopeful now that we're getting not getting past the worst, but approaching the worst?
Yeah, and I think the vast majority of people have towed the line. They've done the right thing. People are focusing on the end result. You know, we need to keep people alive here.
Yeah.
There's only a few COVID idiots, as they call them, swanning around as if it doesn't apply to them.
Indeed.
But, you know, we've got to do the right thing. And hopefully what we're doing here is some sort of help to people. Helping, or what are we doing? Being Vera Lynn now? You know, we're not exactly going to start singing, but whatever we can do to help, we all should be doing it.
We should indeed. Okay, folks, so you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, Leslie Ann and myself. We have got over the technological problems, folks, of not being in a studio, and we are now able to do it respectively from my studio at home and Leslie Ann's from home. So please enjoy the next 40 minutes or so on Life on Planet Porky. Now, I tell you whose birthday it is today. One of the most beautiful actresses that I've ever admired, and that is Julie Christie. Now, did you ever have the luck to meet Julie Christie?
I never met her, but I've always admired her. She's one of those incredible women who manages to retain her allure into her 80s. I think she's 80 today, isn't she?
80 today, yeah.
I was trying to think of other examples of women who remain sort of sexy and alluring as old women. And the only one I could think of is Judi Dench, who's got such a wonderful childlike quality about her. But she's really quite cute and sexy as well.
Yeah.
And I think there is something indefinable about women who manage to do that.
Yeah.
And Julie Christie, I've seen her quite recently in a film playing an old woman. She was playing a grandmother in the film that Johnny Depp made about J.M. Barrie, you know, who wrote Peter Pan.
Yes.
Finding Neverland or something like that. And she played the old grandmother in that, quite witchily, but she was still very beautiful. Do you remember that amazing film, The Go-Between?
the go-between. Are we talking Julie Christie here?
Yeah, back in the 70s, early 70s.
The two I remember were Dr. Zhivago, in which I thought she was so beautiful, you know, against the backdrop of the Russian winter and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And was it the French? No, French left tennis woman was Meryl Streep, wasn't it?
Meryl Streep, yeah.
Which was the one she starred? Because didn't she have a long affair with Terence Stamp, who was also an incredibly handsome-looking actor? And she starred in a film with him, I think, didn't she?
Yeah, maybe. I guess probably the 60s, before I was around, you know. I can't remember that bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the go-between, she it was the L.P. Hartley novel, the novel with the greatest opening line of all time.
Yeah.
The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. I won a quiz on that once. A wonderful film about a well-to-do young woman who had an affair with the gamekeeper and got pregnant by him. And this little boy was the go-between. He had to take the notes from her to the gamekeeper and from the gamekeeper to her.
Yeah.
And when the family found out about it, the gamekeeper shot himself dead through the mouth.
Yeah.
And this little boy witnessed everything, and it ruined his whole life. It's a very, very affecting film, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be. I love Dr. Zhivago for the closing scenes where she's on a bus in Moscow, you know.
Heartbreaking.
Their affair. And old, what was the name of the male lead in that? Very handsome.
Omar Sharif
is running alongside the bus, you know. Oh, darling, darling.
When he has a heart attack. Oh, my God, and he kneels over in the street and never gets to speak to her again.
No, I know. Wasn't that heartbreaking? But when they lived together in the ice palace in the forest, you know, I thought, what an idyllic lifestyle. And then the White Army come along and they steal him as a doctor and take him away. And, it was all so full of terrible tragedy.
Oh, but it was awful because there were wolves crawling around the house at night and they knew that there were humans in there.
Oh, I know.
Oh, I mean, who could stand it? Wonderful story.
Yeah.
Boris Pasternak wrote that, didn't he? But
I worked with his, would it have been his granddaughter or his great niece, the one who wrote the book?
About, Anna.
Yeah.
Anna Pasternak,
yeah. Yeah, she wrote the book about Diana and what's his name? You know, the dude.
James Hewitt.
Hey? James Hewitt, that's right, yeah, yeah. Amazing project, wasn't it? Because it was supposed to be a novel, but of course it was all about Diana and Hewitt, wasn't it?
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, people have often said, haven't they, that James Hewitt is the real father of Harry.
No, he can't be.
But Diana hadn't actually met him at that point, but she had Prince Harry, so I don't really understand that rumour.
No, I don't either, but it's a good one to put up. What about Terence Stamp? He was an amazingly handsome chap, wasn't he? And do you know he never got married, Terence Stamp? And he's over 80 now, if he's not dead. I'm not sure. Apologies to Terence if he's still alive, or apologies if he's dead, obviously. But he never got married, and it was because of, you know, somebody speculated, because of his romance with Julie Christie. After you've been Julie Christie's boyfriend, there's nothing left in life worth marrying, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. He was involved with The Who.
Was it?
Early on with Kit Lambert,
yeah.
In their management in the early days.
Yeah, oh, right.
I seem to have read somewhere. Obviously, we weren't there.
This noise, by the way, is just the chinking of the glass in the...
are you having a drink already?
Oh, yeah. It's gone 11:30.
11:26, Mike.
Just a fun. Yeah, well, there you go. Don't worry about it too much. Now, I tell you what I want to talk to you about, as I always do. It's your John Lennon book. Tell us of progress of that, please. I want to know when it's coming out. The reason I ask is because there has been some reviews of another book written about the Beatles, not about John Lennon, in which I picked up a fact that... there have been 762 books written about the Beatles, right? Since the Beatles broke up in 1970. So I want you to tell us why yours is going to be the best.
Well, my book's not about the Beatles. It's about John Lennon.
Yeah,
and it hinges to this year's anniversary. So it will incredibly have been 40 years since John died.
Mm.
He would have turned 80 this coming 9th of October. This month, obviously, is the official 50th anniversary of the Beatles breaking up.
Yeah.
And it's 60 years since the Beatles in Hamburg.
Yeah.
So to consolidate all of those anniversaries and to reflect on John, to look back on his life and to deliver him to a new generation who probably never knew really who he was.
Yeah.
You know, people understand John Lennon today in a way that that guy didn't exist.
Yeah.
So I wanted to repackage the original John for the younger generation.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fantastic. Now, let me throw this one at you, because this week it was Julian Lennon's birthday, and much to my utter shock, I couldn't believe that Julian Lennon, son of John Lennon to Cynthia Lennon when he was in his early 20s, is now 54 years of age.
Well, yeah, he would be. Sean Lennon is 44. I mean, that I find astonishing.
Whoa, that's incredible.
Sean Lennon. I still think of him as a little baby.
Yeah.
But, you know, Yoko is 87. Time has ticked on. It's kind of gone behind our backs, hasn't it? We all like to think we're still in the prime of our lives. But we're knocking on a bit here, Mike.
Yeah, well, I suppose we are knocking on a bit. Did you know John Blake well in Fleet Street?
Very well. I see. He's still a great friend of mine. I still see John. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I remember when Julian Lennon first started to try and make his way as a star in his own right, I remember that John Blake gave him full support in his column all the time. John did the original Bizarre column, and he was always writing about him and all that. And I think at about 17 or 18, didn't Julian make his first record? You know, It's Much Too Late for Goodbyes or something.
You know what? He was a really credible artist, and he showed great promise in the beginning.
Right.
But the problem there, and the thing that he hated, and the thing that drove him away from the music industry in the end, was that his record company were trying to package him as a new John Lennon. They wouldn't allow him to be an independent artist in his own right.
Yeah.
And he got sick of the comparisons in the end.
Yeah.
He was a good musician, he was a good songwriter, and he had a very distinctive voice.
Mm-hmm.
But tried to give us the new John Lennon, and he didn't have a good relationship with his father. He was abandoned by his dad.
Yeah.
You know, the relationship that John had with Sean, his second son, was the one that Julian should have had.
Yeah.
John turned his back on him, and there was a very good reason for that. Yoko's daughter, Kayoko, had been kidnapped by her biological father, and Yoko spent the next 30 years trying to make contact with her.
Yeah.
John Lennon never saw his stepdaughter again.
Yeah.
It's a horrific story. And because she'd lost her daughter, she couldn't stand to be around children until she had Sean. So John wasn't able to maintain his relationship with Julian.
Yeah.
It's one of the most tragic parental stories I've ever heard.
I totally agree. And I haven't heard anything about Julian Lennon for literally decades. You know what I mean? He just disappeared. I think he had an ongoing row with Yoko about John's money, about the, you know, the estate and all that kind of stuff, because she got it all, didn't she, as his wife. But I agree with you, so tragic. And for instance, you know Paul McCartney very well. You met him up in Liverpool last year, I think it was. And again, when you're the son of somebody who's made such an impact on the cultural and music life of this country, you've got nowhere to go. But Paul McCartney's got a son who you very, very rarely hear of.
James McCartney, yeah, because obviously Paul's original name is James. Also a musician, but quite reclusive.
Yeah.
We don't hear much about him. We don't hear much about Danny Harrison, George's son, do we? But Ringo's son, Zach Starkey, is actually a very credible drummer.
Yeah.
He drums with The Who, and he's drummed with all kinds of other artists as well.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, there was an idea people were floating a long time ago that they should recreate the Beatles with the children of the originals.
Yeah.
But, you know, they didn't live up to it talent-wise, did they? I can't think of a single artist whose child has been as good as them or has eclipsed them over the years. Can you?
Well, how can you? excuse me. It's a good job none of Beckham's sons, his three sons, took up football, because imagine the comparison. We've seen it happen over the years. Johan Cruyff's son took up football. He was quite a good footballer, but it was always a comparison to his father. It always will be. And the only guy I can think of who came out of his father's shadow was Jamie Redknapp, really, who, you know, Harry Redknapp was a credible footballer. I don't think he was an international, but he was a first division player with West Ham. Jamie Redknapp did better. It's happened on a couple of occasions, but not always. Now, talking about people's credibility, Leslie Ann, because you and I have talked about this on previous podcasts, I see for the first time in this morning's newspapers, friends are starting to talk about Harry struggling in his new life in California. That's not a case of I told you so, is it?
Well, are we surprised? You know, he's a fish out of water over there. If he had any sense at all, and I know he can't move around now, but he should get back here, roll up his sleeves, pitch in, you know, rule Britannia. He's one of us. Show us what you're made of, Harry. Obviously, he can't fly back home now. Yeah. But there are ways and means, you know, for rich people, let's say. Yeah. But I think he's got an opportunity here to really rehabilitate his reputation.
Yeah.
He should come home.
I don't think he did any. Didn't do himself any good. Didn't do Megan any good. Didn't do anything any good by starting to talk about his new problems moving to California in the middle of the world, you know, shut down on COVID-19.
No, their timing has been terrible all the way down the line.
Yeah.
And then suddenly she launches her whole new Disney career while tens of thousands of people are dying across the globe.
Yeah.
You know, it's very me on her part, isn't it? And I tried really hard in the beginning to have empathy for her and to try and understand what she was going through. But frankly, no, there is no room for selfishness right now. It's all hands on deck. Everybody has to look out for everybody else. Mm. This is not about your acting career. This is about the future of the world, frankly.
Yeah, of course it is, yeah, and whatever they want to do. I can see him coming back in the end. I think one of these days he's going to wake up in the autumn or maybe in the winter in California and he's going to think, why is the sun shining? He's going to realise, hang on, this is the day of some, you know, great event in Britain, like, you know, his grandmother's official birthday or the Trooping of the Colour or something like that when it should be cold. And maybe on Boxing Day when he would normally have been walking the walk to the chapel in Windsor, you know, in Great Windsor Park and all that, and suddenly think, what have I done? I think it might hit him like that, you know, what have I done? Remember, I'll tell you what film was on yesterday, and again, this is before your time, Leslie, and it's even before mine, actually, but it was The Bridge Over the River Kwai, okay?
Oh, God, yeah, that used to be on regularly when we were kids.
Yeah, absolutely, Alec Guinness. And the whole point of the film is how Alec Guinness was driven mad by his sense of purpose and duty and keeping a British Army regiment together. They were forced to build a bridge over the River Kwai. So in his warped thinking, even though they're prisoners of war of the Japanese, he said to himself, you know, we've got to make this of British engineering standard and all this kind of stuff, you know? And then right towards the end of the film, found that a bunch of commandos were going to blow the bridge up to stop the Japanese army being on the move in Burma or somewhere. And he tried to thwart the plot until it suddenly came to him, what on earth am I doing? I shouldn't be thwarting this plot to blow up the bridge. I should be assisting it. And I think Harry will wake up one day and it'll just come to him like that. What am I doing? I shouldn't have been abandoning the royal family. I should have been contributing to them. I think he's got a really sad future.
Well, what he has done is contribute to the demise of the royal family, because I've long believed that once Her Majesty passes, God save the Queen, that people's interest will wane. You know, they've been hanging on by their fingernails for quite a long time now. I thought it was wonderful when the Queen came out and spoke to the nation, and I feel that she should be doing that more frequently.
Yes.
You know, we need to hear from her in this hour of need.
Yeah.
The rest of the royals, what have they done? Charles and Camilla
buggered
off to Balmoral, and they're sitting there nice and safe and tightly.
Yeah.
And they've presumably got people still cooking their meals and laundering their clothes and doing their garden, while the rest of us are all muddling through. We need William and Harry now to be down here with their sleeves rolled up with the people going, how can I help?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Let's get to a bit of telly because as we record this, it's in the middle of the three-part of The Quiz, which is the TV drama of the cheating major, the coughing major, who won £1 million but was later found to have won it by nefarious means. Have you seen any of the episodes yet?
Watched the first one and was gripped by it, although I had read Chris Tarrant's piece in the Mail.
Yeah, I did.
Denouncing the series as being inaccurate because he said that the show is too sympathetic towards the cheats.
Yes,
and that actually they were criminals. They did set out to defraud the program of £1 million.
Mm.
And there was a lot of desperation going on there. But I find it very plausible, having sat through the first part.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Sheen, the actor who's playing Chris Tarrant, is incredible. What an extraordinary actor he is.
Yeah.
That could be Chris Tarrant, sat there. I think that the major's wife is very plausible. Her brother is very desperate.
Yeah.
The major, which is Matthew McFadden, I think.
Yeah.
He hasn't quite got to me yet. But let's see what the second part does.
Yeah, I think McFadden's a great actor. Did you see Succession? Drama. It's a TV drama based largely on the Murdoch family, you know, and succession to the role of the billionaire father magnate, media magnate when he dies. And McFadden plays the husband of the tycoon's daughter on the periphery of the family, looking in from the outside, you know what I mean? Brilliant actor, brilliant English actor. But no, you're absolutely right. I read Chris's book. I like Chris very much, by the way. I've had him on the radio.
Me too. Love Chris,
As a guest many times. He's very keen on his fishing. He always does that. But he's a really good lad, Chris, because he became very, very famous and was a huge star both on Capital Radio and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. But always, whenever we met, and we weren't great friends, we met socially, he was very down to earth, Chris, and you must have come across him a lot.
Very much so. I worked at Capital Radio years ago, which was my first job when I was first out of college. And my great friend, Russ Kane, to this day, was the flying eye. And Russ and Chris had an incredible on-air sort of banter, which people used to tune in just for that. You know, they were so funny together.
Yeah.
And Russ was actually devastated when Chris decided to pull out of The Breakfast Show.
Yeah.
But then he was a major star on TV, and they made millions.
Yeah.
His company, Celador, they sold the concept of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire all over the world, and they made so much money.
Yeah.
So he never needs to work again, really. But you're right, it never changed him.
No, never changed him. And I felt really sorry for him, although you shouldn't ever feel sorry for anybody who gets done for drunk driving. But years and years ago in Fleet Street, we all know what used to go on there. But I feel very sorry for him when he miscalculated how much he'd drunk in his local pub, okay, which was less than half a mile from his home, okay? And we've all done it. You're in the car, you're on your way out to stop for a quick one. You can miscalculate. If you have 2 pints these days, you are over the limit, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But what really got me was that Chris got home. He got home safely, and there was no problem. And then there was a knock on the door, and some policemen arrived, policewomen. And the problem had been that somebody in the pub had decided to report Chris Tarrant. Now, I'm not in any way defending drink driving, nor would I ever. It's despicable because it puts other people in danger. But that is a rather un-British, underhanded trick, in my view.
Well, it is. Of course it is. It's a despicable thing to do.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have done it. Half a mile is not very far to walk, let's say. You know, it's only up the road, isn't it? So you shouldn't have done it. No, of course not. But imagine being that snitch.
Yes.
Imagine going throughout your life. I remember we had a guy outside my son's school, Dulwich College, years ago.
Right.
And there was a stretch of road outside the school where the double yellow lines, and you were not allowed to park. But lots of parents used to park there to walk their kids into school.
Yeah.
And this dad, it was a really snitchy dad. He used to walk up and down with a spirally bound notepad, taking down the number plates of all the cars that were illegally parked, and then he would take it in and give it to the head.
Yeah.
And I thought, who does that? You know, what kind of sad bastard spends their time doing that?
I agree. I mean,
you've got it going on now. You've got people putting notes through the doors of nurses and doctors saying that they're going to report them because they shouldn't be, they should be staying in, they shouldn't be going out to work, not realizing that those people work in the NHS.
No, I totally agree. I've got a second home, right? And I decided once lockdown came not to go there. You obviously are up to date with the row about the government minister who drove 140 miles to Herefordshire to his.
Oh, Robert Jenner. I mean, how dare he?
How dare he drive
all the way to Shropshire after telling us that we all need to stay in? And may I ask, while we're on that subject, Why did Boris drive to Chequers? Why was he not made to stay in Downing Street? Because that's a long distance as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Rules for him and rules for us.
Yeah, well, yes, but I think Chequers would have been like an isolation ward for him. Nobody else is going there to see him. You see what I mean? So it's not the
real. Still driving there, and you're still potentially taking the virus on the wheels of your car.
Well,
that's why they've told all of us not to drive.
You are absolutely right, but I would balance that against the number of people who move around Downing Street 10 and 11. There's hundreds of them. You see what I mean? I think he's.
Yeah, I agree.
I think he's better out of it. And when you say drive, you went to. I'm told, in a sealed car, you know, like an ambulance type thing. But anyway, that's by the by. But let
it
me
still drives on the roads and it can still potentially pick up the virus.
No, I totally agree. But look, let me just get you on to the snitch and all that kind of stuff. I'll tell you about an experience for me. So I can't go to one of my second homes because, quite rightly, the neighbours, they're both blocks of apartments, would have seen my car parked in my car parking space down below. Do you see what I mean? And they knew my car. It's very distinctive. They would have seen me there. They'd have had every right to say, because there's a very, very low level of infection in some coastal towns, and they're both on the coast. And one of them would have said, why have you brought that down from London, which is perceived to be the epicentre of the virus? So I haven't gone for those reasons. It would have been completely unfair. However, I've got a roof garden at my place in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, where I am now. I'm in my office deep into the heart of my apartment. But if I go through down a corridor, through two rooms, out into the kitchen door leads on to my roof garden, okay? And it's a nice little roof garden, and I can sit there, you know, and there's a bit of shade and all that, and there's loads of flowers.
Yeah, passing around yours when this is all over.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And it's very pleasant. So the other day, I'm sitting there. In fact, I'm not sitting there, I'm in my kitchen with the door open, and my neighbour across the fence, because we both agreed to construct fences which are nicely done so we weren't staring across the wall at each other. Do you know what I mean? It's agreed on both sides, no problem. I suddenly hear three voices instead of two because he lives there with his partner, and all of a sudden I hear a third voice. So, being the measured sort of chap I am, I then, about an hour later, sent him an email and very politely pointed out that I thought there were only two people living in your home. I heard a third voice. I am not in any way, accusing, and please accept my apology if I'm wrong, but if the third person has come to your apartment, they've come from outside, they've visited, they may have potentially brought the virus into our block of apartments. Anyway, it was amazing, the response.
Was he nice? Did he have a go at you?
No, he wrote back and said, a third person is now living there. There is no reason for alarm. I'm very, very sorry, you know, that you think we may have broken distancing rules and all that kind of. I said, look, it's your roof garden, mate. I said, I just want to know. I said, because whoever the third person is, if they're a visitor, they've put their hand on the door handle to get in. They've put their hand on the rails that lead to the lifts and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? They've touched the lift button, which I have to touch. And the funny thing is, Leslie-Anne, that I got a fulsome apology and then the apartment's been closed down. I haven't seen anybody there since. So, so I think people, you know, don't realise what they should be doing and can get incredibly sensitive about it if you point it out. So I don't want to be accused of being a snitch, but I do think we all have a responsibility to point these things out.
Of course, you're not being a snitch because you didn't go and tell somebody else. You had a word with them quietly. That's a whole different thing. Mm. And you have every right to do that.
Yeah, I do.
So my sister lives up on the Suffolk coast, and she said that their local shop was coping very well with, you know, just their local demands until the London lot all started rocking up to their second homes.
Yeah.
And now they've cleared the shelves of the local shop. They can't get anything.
Yeah.
The head of the parish council, who was supposed to be dealing with this, has buggered off to his daughters in Scotland.
Right.
You know, breaking the rules again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at the weekend, because the weather was so good and the sea is at the end of her road.
Yeah.
Incomers in their droves.
Yes.
And they tried a roadblock. The locals tried a roadblock. Yes. The police tried to stop them.
Yeah.
But there was nothing they could do. Where is the sense in these people. Why do they think the rules don't apply to them?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. The other issue here with the roof garden, by the way, is that the COVID-19 virus is airborne. And one of the people on the other side of the fence was weightlifting. I mean, they were...
Oh, God, puffing and blowing, yeah?
They were working out. And not only that, perspiration. And it can fly off your body in perspiration, all that. So I got quite alarmed. But anyway, look, the response from the chap I'm talking about was absolutely quite right. Locked up. I don't know whether they've left, by the way, or whether they're just not coming out to their roof garden. You know what I mean?
But it, maybe they died.
It was all locked up, yeah. Now, you talk about Suffolk. That's another... a location I could have gone to. I've got a place in a place called Orwell Quay, which is just outside Ipswich, and it's on the...
Are you Five Mansions Parry now, are you?
No, not at all, no. It's just that, you know, it's they're just investment properties. But, no, what I was going to say is the temptation to go out on the Suffolk coast is enormous because it's so beautiful. Some of the villages on the sea there, as you probably well know, are utterly stupendous, and they're empty. And the temptation to walk along an empty beach on the Suffolk coast must be enormous, but you just can't do it. Now, there's something else I want to talk to you just before we go, Leslie Ann, and it's been an absolute delight talking to you today. Honestly, it really has. Great therapy and all that. But you will have noticed, of course, because of the sporting background you have with your father and your uncle, that Stirling Moss has died this week.
Oh, yeah, God rest his soul. He was 90, though, so I, you know... It's not so sad, is it? He had a good life.
He was a great guy, honestly. I couldn't believe that when he was 80, I knew this had happened, I didn't realise how old he was. He lived in a 5-storey home in Mayfair, okay? Made a lot of money during his life, done well on, you know, all sorts of investments, property. When he was 80, he went to the lift in his house. He'd had a lift fitted because he was 80 years of age. He pressed the button for the lift door to open, stepped inside, no lift. He fell 50 feet onto the top of the lift. He broke both ankles, a leg, and damaged his spine, which you would if you step into an empty void and fall 50 feet. But I couldn't believe he didn't die.
He was very, very lucky, wasn't he?
Very, very lucky indeed. But the biggest thing about him that I mentioned to you when we were swapping notes was you said, oh, I didn't know he was known as a super shagger.
I never knew that.
Oh, God, it was the best-known story in sport in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. Stirling Moss had two sets of diaries all the time. One of them was his motor racing achievements, and the other one was his sexual conquests. And there were more entries in the sexual conquest one, many more, than there were in the motor racing one. He was renowned as, you know, the swordsman of all times on the motor racing circuit and gloried in it and loved it. He said, it's one of the reasons I took up motor racing. He said, any motor racing circuit, there are always lots of pretty girls around. Well,
and do you know what they call those girls? They have the best moniker known to man. The girls who hang around a racetrack are known as screwdrivers.
Screwdrivers? I didn't know that. I thought you were going to say pit girls, because I thought they were all known as pit girls as opposed to pit bulls. Although I bet a few of them were a few pit bulls.
Well, exactly. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who was very close to Stirling Moss.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He told me that the flags at the RAC club in Piccadilly,
yes,
which was Stirling's club,
yeah,
are flying at half mast in his honour, which I thought was rather lovely.
Yeah, I interviewed him a couple of times. I met him once. And I have to say, he was the epitome of the English gentleman. Do you know what I mean? Charm personified, easygoing, naturally. Jackie Stewart said something interesting. So Jackie Stewart, he said, he walked like a racing driver. He had this debonair sort of, you know, strolling gait about him. You know what I mean? He was just a lovely guy. And, you know, that must have been a fantastic era to have been a young woman in the company of racing drivers, because the other guy who I thought was just a wonderful, wonderful Englishman was...
James Hunt?
Well, I was about to come to James Hunt. I would say Graham Hill in the 50s and 60s, but they were all surpassed. And this is in one of the obituaries to Stirling Moss. They were all surpassed by the blonde-haired James Hunt, who absolutely swept across the world, didn't he?
Well, he did. And of course, in those days as well, motor racing was a sport. Mm. Stirling Moss himself said it's more of a business now. He said, you know, Lewis Hamilton wins a race, he has to come off the track and talk to his sponsor.
Yes.
Whereas he said, if I won a race, I'd instantly be off the track trying to find another bit of crumpet.
That's right.
I think it was dangerous in those days. I wouldn't say that motor racing is so dangerous now,
no,
because it's all about tech. Everything is controlled.
That's right.
Everything is changed every few minutes.
Yep.
And it's more about engineering than it is about driving.
Yes. Well, yes, people always say Hamilton only won because he had the best car. My view is that the people who spend trillions on producing the best car want the best driver to get in it. And what other people don't understand, Leslie-Ann, and I'm not trying to be an expert on this, is that when Michael Schumacher went to Ferrari, Ferrari were a poor team. Their engineering was poor, the design was poor. And what they did is they said to Schumacher, who'd won world titles with Benetton, the colours of Benetton, they said, it's going to take us 3 years to make the car right, but you're the guy who's going to make it right. And what these drivers do is they sit in that car and they do thousands of circuits and they get out and they say to the engineers, right, this needs doing, that needs doing. I heard a noise on this. Do you see what I mean? They kind of engineer the car by instinct and the feel of their body inside the car.
Yeah, there's a great art to that, isn't there?
Yeah.
I can begin to understand. But I think things were a lot simpler in Stirling Moss's day.
Yes,
and,
very much,
you know, give the modern guys their due.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Did you know James Hunt, by the way?
No, again, I was a bit too young. You know, I just sort of came in on the back end of all that.
Yeah.
But I did used to watch motor racing on television in those days.
Yeah.
And it was very, very exciting. And do you remember when Ayrton Senna was around?
Yes.
You know, that film they made about him
yes.
was one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, he was incredible, Ayrton Senna. He was an utter legend. Stirling Moss, once talking about James Hunt, said, you know, James Hunt took my mantle as Lothario of the racetrack. And he referred to the fact that whenever there was a race in a capital like Barcelona or Tokyo or Sao Paulo in Brazil, he said all James Hunt used to do was insist that his people booked him into the same hotel where the British Airways crews were booked. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, he was after the trolley dollies.
Of course he was. Of course he was. And then when he got there, he'd say, right, when's the next jumbo in from London, you know? And they'd say... And
that's not a euphemism.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's the next jumbo in. And then he would sit in the, you know, the lobby of the hotel and pretend just to be sitting there casually talk to a friend. And as the crew piled in, you know, it was sort of four men and 16 women, you see what I mean? That all the women would go goggle-eyed. Oh, isn't that James Hunt? And this would be the night before a Formula One race, you know. And Stirling Moss said, James would then say, let's have a bit of a party in my room. He said none of the girls ever turned him down. So he'd have like 12 or 14 women there with him and Barry Sheen. Do you remember Barry Sheen?
Oh my God.
Yeah, Barry Sheen. Barry Sheen had retired by this time, but he used to travel the world with James just so they could all get their hands on British Airways trolley dollies, to use your expression, which, of course, I never would because I'm a gentleman, you know.
Well, there you are, but I can say it. But the thing is, where are these women's brains? You know, you know that he's not going to marry you. Why would you become, sorry to use the expression, a sperm receptacle for James Hunt?
Oh, dear.
It's a family show, right?
He was just a very charming chap, and he was British and had a great voice and this, you know, this blonde hair and all that. I know a female journalist, which I respect.
Should remain nameless.
No, she's not going to remain nameless. It's Caroline Graham.
We love Caroline Graham.
Of course we do. West Coast correspondent for the Mail on Sunday, who actually wrote a very touching piece in Sunday's paper about how...
Oh, about her mum. She's holed up in a single room with her mother in a care home.
That's right. Rushed back to Britain when she found out her mum was so ill, and that's what she's doing now. But Caroline knew James Hunt from a very early age. Even before she became a journalist, for some reason, something to do with her family, they ended up in the same hotel somewhere, I think, in Berkshire or somewhere like that, where James Hunt was, you know? And she was too young to sort of be dating or anything like that, but he became a family friend, you know what I mean? And she knew him for years, and obviously when she...
There's more to that. There is definitely more to that. We need to find out.
No. Caroline is a woman of great virtue, and she tells me that she was only ever friends with James Hunt. Caroline says that. I have to believe her. Well, look, Leslie Ann, we haven't hopped around the subject today, haven't we? And it's been a great pleasure to be able to have the opportunity to chew the fat with you and exchange a few ideas. How are you looking forward now to the next 3 weeks?
Well, I've got plenty of work to do. I'm editing my own manuscript, a ghostwrite that I'm working on at the moment. Yeah. I'm helping my daughter with her dissertation for her university degree, so I've been editing a bit of Shakespeare. I've always got something on the boil, so yeah. I'm actually just working. This is business as usual for me. Sure. I spend most of my time in my office at my desk writing.
Yeah, good.
So apart from, you know, teaming up with you in the studio, once a week to do our podcast, and I'm missing you very much, got to say.
Well,
but you know, all will be restored soon enough.
Well, we hope so. What you have to have, and I've read a book about this actually, but before I read the book about it, it happened to me at Harefield Hospital. I was there for about 7 months, okay, and the thing is, when you can't see the end of the trail, when you can't see the light of the tunnel, you have to focus on something you really love to do that's going to keep you going. And when I was in hospital, I couldn't get out of bed. I was wired up to all sorts of heart machines and all that. All I could think about was having a drink with Alan Brazil in our favourite wine bar on Ludgate Hill, okay, after we'd come to the breakfast show at 10 o'clock. That's all I could focus on. And you know what? 5 months later, it actually happened, you know, and that's what you're going to focus on. So at the moment, talk to you here, I'm focusing, right, on that Thai restaurant we went to one day after we'd been recording Maple Street Creative Studios, okay? And we had a lovely, delightful afternoon with a couple of bottles of the best wine and some terrific food.
What a great day that was, and what fabulous food.
Yeah.
What was the name of that square? Fitzrovia Square?
Fitzrovia Square, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. It was, yes, let's do that. As soon as we get out, let's head back there and have another one.
I totally agree. Now, just before we go, Leslie Ann, I have written a poem about the pub situation, okay, to try and keep all our listeners, our followers, our friends in good spirits, and I want to read it to you. Is that okay?
Please do. Fire away.
Right, but hang on, I've lost it. This is the point. I'm not very well
organized. Oh, come on, just look. Come on, get your act.
I'm in my office. I'm just going to find it. Hang on one sec, please.
He's lost it. I mean, what is this? Okay. You know, have a piece of paper ready in your hand. Come on.
No, I have it. Well, I've got all sorts of scripts all over me. This is going to close our podcast today, folks. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Leslie Ann, if you want to give the listeners a message before I close it with my poem.
So keep your pecker up, guys. You know, keep staying in, keep washing your hands, protect the NHS. Get out there on Thursday night at 8 o'clock and clap the guys for all that they're doing for us. Chins up, chests out. We'll be out of this soon.
Absolutely right. Here comes the poem. Ode to the English Tavern by Porky Wordsworth Parry. Oh, to be in an English pub in spring. The frothing ales and casks of beer and all the joys it brings. The locals standing round the bar, in the wheat sheaf on the square. We've all got problems in this world, but not when we're in there. We see our friends to laugh and shout as the booze warms up our blood. And life's on hold for a couple of hours. That is understood. So savour the thought of a glass in your hand, red wine, Pinot or gin, because one day ahead, they'll open the doors and let us all back in. Cheerio.
Hooray! Brilliant.
He was renowned as, you know, the swordsman of all times on the motor racing circuit and gloried in it and loved it. He said, it's one of the reasons I took up motor racing. He said, any motor racing circuit, there are always lots of pretty girls around. Well,
and do you know what they call those girls? They have the best moniker known to man. The girls who hang around a racetrack are known as screwdrivers.
Oh, to be in an English pub in spring. The frothing ales and casks of beer and all the joys it brings. The locals standing round the bar in the wheat sheaf on the square. We've all got problems in this world, but not when we're in there. We see our friends to laugh and shout as the booze warms up our blood. And life's on hold for a couple of hours. That is understood. So savour the thought of a glass in your hand, red wine, Pinot or gin, because one day ahead, they'll open the doors and let us all back in. Do you know, he never got married, Terence Stamp, and he's over 80 now, if he's not dead, I'm not sure. Apologies to Terence if he's still alive, or apologies if he's dead, obviously.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.